had applied, so Mr. Turner admitted the 6 with the best grades, which left me out. The 7th applicant, the one who beat me out, was Dorothy Plunk. Dad studied me. "Let me get this straight. You fought for a class, got it, and now you can't take it?" "Too true. You want me to talk to Mr. Turner?" I shook my head. "No, sir. He did the fair thing." Dad nodded. "Yes, he did. I'm happy you recognize that." He went into the living room with the tray, and soon I heard his laughter. I trudged up the stairs. At the top of the steps in the hall, there was a huge bookcase, 6 shelves tall. I turned on the hall light and found myself looking at the books, an idle activity. Then my eyes lit on one. It was titled Advanced Mathematics, A Guide for Self-Study. It was well-thumbed, some of the pages dog-eared. Its index included several chapters on differential equations and calculus. I found a piece of yellowed notebook paper within. Calculations on it, in Dad's handwriting. I realized I was holding the book he had used to teach himself the mathematics he needed for his job. Then I wondered why he hadn't mentioned it to me. Maybe, I fumed, he didn't think I could learn what was in it. Reverend Lanier once preached that when a door is shut in our faces, we shouldn't worry because someday, if we're properly patient, God just might open another. My mother, never the patient sort, had a different idea. If a door closes, she amended to me after his sermon, find yourself a window and climb through it. I took Dad's book. It was mine now, into my room. It was the golden age of rock and roll, even for us kids in deepest West Virginia. At night, when we could hear stations far from our mountains, we usually tuned to a station in Gallatin, Tennessee that played hearty black rock and roll. We came to love Chuck Berry, Laverne Baker, the Coasters, Fats Domino, Shirley and Lee, Ivory Joe Hunter, and Joe Turner. When Elvis and Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis came along, we listened to them too, usually on WLS out of Chicago, but our hearts were always with the black groups Gallatin brought us. And also anything Ed Johnson played. Ed Johnson was the man who guided the classes of Big Creek High School through the golden era of rock and roll. He was a one-man recreation department in blue jeans and a V-neck sweater, playing for our dancing pleasure all the latest records on his homemade hi-fi system. Ed's favorite place to play his records was the Dugout, which was actually the basement of the Owl's Nest restaurant just across the river from the high school. The Dugout was sparsely furnished, booth benches with backs on them along the walls, and support pilings scattered throughout the room that cut into the dancing space. It was also dimly lit, just a few pink and blue light bulbs in the low ceiling. There was a furnace with a coal pile beside it over in one corner. The Dugout had nothing going for it except that we loved it. It was our little piece of rock and roll heaven. You could always tell how much you'd danced at the Dugout if you pulled off your socks that night and looked at the black ring around your ankles from the coal dirt. Sherman called on a Saturday in April, saying we needed to take a break from rocket building and go to the Dugout. I agreed. I told Sherman I thought maybe we could catch a ride over with Jim since he had the Buick, but by the time I got around to asking, he'd already taken off. Mom said he'd spent even longer than usual getting ready for his date, so she had to be somebody pretty special. I didn't say it to Mom, but they were all pretty special to Jim. He had cut a wide swath through the girls of Big Creek High, leaving behind him a crowd of broken hearts. Sherman and I stood in the dirt on the other side of the gas station for only a few minutes before someone picked us up and took us to Coretta. After a few more minutes with our thumbs out, somebody else came along and took us all the way to War. There we kicked down the street, easing into the sweet shop and eating a hot dog and talking to the rosy-cheeked man behind the counter who complimented us on our pink shirts, black draped and peg pants, white socks, and brown loafers. We were a proud pair, dropping by the pool hall, playing a quick game of 8-ball, and then as the sky darkened, swaggering down the sidewalk. A block away, we could hear the muffled music coming from the Dugout. The dance had been in full swing for an hour. At the door, we were greeted by a blast of warm air and the vision of shadowy dancing bodies. Ed, who knew everybody by name, greeted us. His latest girlfriend, a blonde young honey, stamped a black spot on the back of our hands after we gave her our quarters. Sherman saw a girl he liked and tapped her on the shoulder and hit the dance floor for about 10 straight. His weak leg made him dance a little funny. One foot turned out for balance, but it didn't keep the girls from wanting a turn with him. I edged into the darkness and saw Emily Sue and Tootsie Rose sitting on a bench and went over and talked to them. Connie Peary was home from college, and she snared me for a quick dance while her boyfriend was sneaking a smoke in the parking lot across the river. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Valentine with Buck Trant. They were apparently having a quarrel. She spun on her heel after shaking her finger in his face and stomped out of the dugout. I asked Malby Sue Harlow, a 10th grader, for a slow dance, and then went back out on the floor for a chicken with Lucky Joe Adair, one foot out and then the other, our heads bobbing in time to the beat. Bodies swirled around me, and I inhaled the wonderful, intoxicating aroma of sweat and perfume all mixed up. That was when I saw Dorothy. I had never seen Dorothy at the dugout before. She was standing alone just inside the door, wearing a black skirt and a pale green sweater with the collar of a white blouse peeking out. She had her dancing shoes on. I perked up, thinking that she had come alone, but then I saw her date enter behind her with his two quarters in his hand. I recognized him, recognized his flat top of blonded hair with the ornamental frontal curl, the snarly lips, the athletic lumber. My brother took Dorothy's perfect little hand, and together they walked out under the pink and blue lights and green and white crepe paper and began to dance to a booming Ed Johnson middle act song syncopated by the sound of my broken heart shattering on the concrete floor. How I made my feet and legs move, I do not know, but they got me to an empty bench in the back where I sat as Jim worked his magic stuff on Dorothy in front of my eyes. I was a fascinated spectator in the way the surviving passengers must have been as they watched the Titanic sink. Other dancers swirled around the floor, and some girls even came and asked me to dance, but I did not respond. I was too busy dying a thousand deaths.
Sonny.
It was Valentine.
Would you like to dance?
I looked up at her, and then at her hand held out to me. Ed was playing a slow dance. I took Valentine's hand instinctively, and she walked backward, pulling me to my feet. She bumped into Jim and Dorothy. Dorothy opened her eyes sleepily, and Jim scowled, but they moved out of her way. Valentine draped her arms around my neck. We swayed to the song, and then Valentine's lips were brushing my ear, and I wasn't really thinking about Dorothy and Jim anymore. I cannot say that I remember leaving the dugout with Valentine. When I thought about it later, I did seem to remember Ed patting me on the back in a special, urging way. Valentine and I had to cross the bridge to the parking lot in front of the high school, but I don't remember that either. I do remember Buck's old Dodge and Valentine opening the back door and getting inside, scooting across the bench seat in the back, and then reaching across it to take my hand and draw me inside with her. Then she locked all the doors and settled back, her hands moving to the bottom of her sweater, her arms crossing, and she raised it over her face. She shook out her hair as she dropped the sweater into the front seat. She smelled of musk and desire. Or was that me? She opened her arms and took me in. I thought I heard Buck knocking on the window and wailing something, but not much more. Valentine had found WLS, and the DJ was in a romantic mood. Love is a many-splendored thing. It's the April rose that only grows in the early spring. Santo and Johnny's Sleepwalk was playing when I next came up for air. The windows of the Dodge, steamy and gray, the heavier droplets making curving little translucent streaks down them. I rested on her, my cheek so tight against her, it was as if it were welded to her breast. After a while, she eased me up and out of the car. She leaned across the seat on her knees and touched me on my nose.
Other women will have you in your life, but nobody will have you first except me, and don't you ever forget that.
And then she closed the door, and I knew it was time for me to go. At the dugout, Ed had already played Good Night, My Love, and the place was empty. I looked at the clock inside the owl's nest and was surprised to see that it was well past midnight. There was a storm in the air, and as I hurried down the sidewalk, the first patter of rain came, and in the distance I saw lightning. A car eased up the road, and I stuck my thumb out, and it stopped. It was 2 a.m. before another ride got me all the way to Colwood. The rain was lashing the valley, and thunder and lightning crashing across the mountains. The tipple area of the mine seemed to be strangely lit, a big spotlight directed at the shaft as my ride carried me past it. When I looked down the valley, there was a light on every porch, and I could see the dark shapes of people walking up the street toward the mine. The back door of my house stood wide open. I came inside cautiously and found Mom sitting at the kitchen table in front of her painting. She stared at me and spoke to me as if she were the guard to the very gates of hell. "You are not to go to the mine. No matter what else you do this night, you mustn't do that." I coaxed out of Mom what had happened. 3 hours before, two fans had been struck by lightning, and 30 minutes after that, a bump had occurred near the face. Then, of course, the black phone rang, and Dad heard there was a fall. Men were hurt, maybe trapped. Methane was surely seeping in. If the fans didn't get going soon, there was likely to be an explosion that would streak through the length of the mine. Dad ordered everybody out who could get out, and then slammed the phone down and ran to the basement. I told him not to go inside. "Let the rescue squad do it," I said. "But no, it's not his way." "I have to go," he said. I told him he just couldn't stand that somebody else might go inside his precious mine and do something without him. "So now you're home. I'm not even going to ask you where you've been. Go to your room and go to bed. That's where Jim is. What goes on inside that filthy pit doesn't concern either one of you." As ordered, I went to my room and looked out the window and saw cars and trucks rushing past, making toward the mine. Then I saw an ambulance coming across the mountain from Welch. Thunder boomed, and lightning flashed, and the rain came in swaths. Townspeople straggled by, carrying umbrellas, their coats pulled tight around their throats. I couldn't stand to hide in my room and not know what was happening. I opened my window and went out on the roof and then swung down over the ledge, caught the windowsill, and dropped into the yard. I hopped the fence and merged with a line of people winding up the path toward the mine. Nearly all of the people of Colwood were gathering there. A barrier of sawhorses had been erected, and the women whose husbands were inside stood in a special place behind them. I heard people talking. The rescue team had descended hours before. There had been no word since. I watched from the shadows of the bathhouse. My thoughts were in turmoil. So much had happened already this night. Dorothy was gone forever. I could never feel about her the same way I had after she'd been with Jim. I watched the men and women of the Salvation Army share a prayer with anyone who seemed to need it. I thought of Valentine, and it gave me no pleasure. My first experience with a girl seemed sad. Valentine had loved me with pity in her heart. Doc waited at the ambulance with its crew, and Mr. Van Dyke watched with a little knot of foremen and engineers from the porch outside Dad's office. Jake was there, too. Little children stood around everywhere with their parents as quiet and stoic as the grown-ups. The night dragged on, the rain ending, and the clouds scudding away and the stars blinking on one by one, looking cold and distant. A breeze rustled the budding trees above us on the mountainside, but like everybody else, my focus was entirely on the silent tipple and the frozen winch wheel on the manhoist. It seemed as if the shaft sighed every time steam rose from it, as if emoting a whisper of anticipation. Mr. Van Dyke came out on the porch after talking on the telephone, and a rumor flashed through the crowd. One of the rescue team had been hurt, but they had broken through. Some men had been found dead. The wives behind the sawhorses dropped their heads and prayed quietly. The winch on the manhoist creaked, and everyone looked up as it slowly began to turn. The people tensed, instinctively knowing that this was what they had been waiting for. On the rising cage were two members of the rescue team, identified by the green crosses taped to their helmets. With them was a stretcher, the body aboard covered by a gray blanket. A miner opened the gate and held it back as they walked the stretcher off. Doc raised the blanket and took off his hat and said something to the wives. A path opened in their ranks, and a woman, her arms wrapped around her old coat as if she were freezing, stepped through it. She walked regally behind the stretcher to the ambulance. When she crossed into the light from the bathhouse, I saw that it was Mary Bykovsky. I couldn't stop the groan that escaped my lips. Please, God, I want this nightmare to end. I started to go to her, but my mother's voice stopped me. No, not now. When Mom came out of the shadows, her eyes shot holes in me. I started to say something to her, probably some cowardly plea for understanding. But before I could, she slapped me as hard as she could in the face. I rocked from it, my cheek burning and tears welling in my eyes from the surprise of it as much as the pain. Her face was twisted with anger. I told you not to come up here, she said. I stood my ground. I was worried about Dad. Her voice was a hiss. No, you weren't. You don't worry about anybody but yourself. That's the way you've always been. Selfish. She turned in disgust and stalked away from me, going into the crowd and out of my sight. I slumped against the bathhouse, my hand to my cheek as if it were glued there. My mother's opinion of me kept ricocheting in my brain. Selfish. The ambulance carrying Mr. Bykovsky started up and slowly rolled down the hill toward the road. I watched it and prayed. Make it stop hurting. Please, God have mercy, make it stop hurting. My prayer caught in my throat. Mr. Bykovsky's body was in that ambulance, and my prayer had been for myself. Mom was right. I had always been selfish. There was yet another reason to be disgusted with myself. The man-hoist winch creaked again, and the waiting wives shuddered as if a cold wind had blown through them. It seemed an eternity, but finally a dozen men came up, their faces black as the night sky. Some of them were being held up by others. A rescue team member stepped out on the ground. He looked at the wives. All alive, he said in a loud voice. All alive. The wives pushed up against the sawhorses and then knocked them over to get at their men. Some fell and picked themselves up, but they kept going. They flew into their husbands, oblivious to the greasy coal smearing their clothes. The children crowded around, clinging to their father's legs. Then I saw my father coming off the lift alone. His helmet was gone, and there was a bloody bandage covering his right eye. He walked stiffly to Mr. Van Dyke. The general superintendent came down off the porch and solemnly shook his hand. Then all the rescue squad crowded around Dad, patting him on the back. He dully accepted their accolades, and then walked clumsily away as if his boots were made of lead. My mother left the crowd but didn't go to him. She just followed. I think she knew it was important to him that he walk home under his own power. I waited until they were down the hill to the road, and then I followed, my cheek where my mother had struck me still on fire. Mom and Dad were in the basement. I could hear the shower running when I slipped inside the house and went to my room. I heard them come up the steps, and then the sound of bed springs giving as he was let down on his bed. Mom went downstairs. Then the black phone rang. It seemed 10 times louder than I'd ever heard it before. Mom came running into the foyer, but instead of picking it up, I heard her tear the phone from the wall, open the front door, and throw it out into the yard. I came out of my room, worried that she might hurt herself. "Go get Doc," she ordered me. I started for the stairs, but Doc had already arrived, stalking into the foyer and up the steps. He and Mom went into Dad's bedroom and closed the door. When Doc came out, Jim and I were waiting in the hall.
I had to put 12 stitches in his forehead. The cable they were using to pull out the loader snapped and hit him in the head. The force of it cracked his helmet in two. He'll probably lose his right eye. I'll have him over to the hospital tomorrow, and we'll know more then.
Doc walked to the banister and turned and looked at us.
12 men would have died tonight if it hadn't been for your dad. That's something a son should know.
I followed Doc out to the back gate. Doc, what about Mr. Bykovsky?
He was operating the loader that got buried.
It was all too much. I couldn't take it any more. I hung my head and started to cry. Doc put a steadying hand on my shoulder.
What's this?
It was my fault. Mr. Bykovsky wouldn't have been there except for me. I told Doc the story, my voice spastic with choked sobs. And if he hadn't been at the face, he would still be alive. I looked up at Doc, meeting his eyes, but there was no sympathy there.
Stop your sniveling. God Almighty, don't you understand the kind of place this is? The men in this town go in that pit and hold hands with death every day.
I couldn't stop my tears, and they shamed me. They ran in rivulets down my cheeks, dripped off my chin. I hated myself for them.
Ike built your rockets because he wanted the best for you, the same as if you were his son. You and all the children in Coalwood belong to all the people. It's an unwritten law, but that's the way everybody feels.
He walked to his car and climbed inside, started the engine, and rolled the window down.
I'm going to tell you what your father would say if he could. Don't let me ever see you act like a sob sister again, or by God, I'll whip you myself. Coalwood is no place to be weak, but if you are, keep it to yourself, and get the hell out of here as soon as you can.
I stood at the gate and watched Doc drive off. I looked up the road toward the tipple and saw the people coming back. I heard what sounded like normal conversation. Somebody even laughed. Mr. Bykovsky was dead, and my dad was maimed, and they were acting like it was all a relief. Only one man was dead. Only one. One man was killed in the mines in McDowell County all the time. The prayers at the shaft had worked well enough. I loathed them all as they passed me by. Loathed that what passed for courage and endurance was in reality apathy, even in the face of death. I wanted no part of them. I wanted only escape, to show my back to Coalwood forever. Mom drove Dad to the hospital the next day. When they got back, Dad's head was bandaged, and there was a thick patch over his eye. He got out of the Buick and leaned against it to get his balance. Mom put his arm over her shoulder and took his weight. I rose to help, unlatching the gate for them. Even though she was struggling, Mom kept me away with a glare. I watched them go into the house, the screen door slamming behind them. I started to follow, but then I felt the worst thing I had ever felt in my life. Nothing. Hawk 21 was fired 3 weeks after the accident, about the time my father, ignoring Doc's orders, got up and went back to work, his right eye blind and glassy, a bloody rent full of stitches still on his forehead. The rocket was almost never launched at all. For days after the accident in the mine, I had felt as if somebody had reached up inside me and turned off a switch. I felt dull and thick. I quit thinking about rockets, quit studying my book, and quit going to the machine shop. I avoided all contact with my parents, getting up early and standing in the dark an hour before the school bus came. I was scared, but I wouldn't admit it, even to myself. Had I turned into one of them at last? Had Mr. Bykovsky's death, my fault, no question, and Dad's accident finally got me where I was always supposed to be? Was I finally a good West Virginian, all stoic and solid, filled everlastingly to my chin with guilt but not capable of showing it? I detested myself for what I considered the abomination of feeling nothing. It was Miss Riley who snapped me out of it. One day after school, she called me aside and asked me why I wasn't working on rockets anymore. I tried to be nonchalant, even cold, but she gently nailed me. You're feeling sorry for yourself, and not a little bit proud. A poor combination. She reached out and took one of my hands, which I found I had balled into a fist. She unwrapped it. Her hand was soft and warm. I knew mine was cold. I had been freezing since the accident. No matter how I piled on the blankets at night, I was still cold. She looked at me steadily. Sonny, a lot has happened to you, probably more than I know. But I'm telling you, if you stop working on your rockets now, you'll regret it maybe for the rest of your life. I pulled my hand away from her. I couldn't let her confuse me, but she persisted. You've got to put all your hurt and anger aside so you can do your job. There it was, the West Virginia thing, the almighty job. I should have known that was coming. Oh, yes, we all had our job to do in this state, breaking our backs to ship our wealth out to the world so we could turn around the next day and do it all over again for next to nothing. What's my job? She ignored my tone. Your job, Sonny, is to build your rockets. I wanted to run from her, tear out of her classroom and keep going and never look back. What if I don't like doing my job? She gave me a look that went down to my marrow. Then, and especially then, Sonny, you give it everything you've got. Watch this rocket fly, I predicted to the boys at the morning BCMA meeting in the auditorium. This one's really going to go. I had apologized to them all for shunning them after the accident, and they had all acted like nothing had ever happened. That was the West Virginia way, and they were better at it than I was. From the moment I pressed the firing button the following weekend, I knew it was our best rocket yet. A hot, conical flame spurted from AUK-21's base as it accelerated off the pad. It darted for the blue sky, a long white contrail flowing out behind it. A couple of other Big Creek boys, Dean Crabtree and Ronnie Sizemore, had joined us for the day to help out around the range. Mr. Dubonnet, our machinists, and 30 other Coldwoodians cheered. The AUK hurtled downrange exactly as planned. I savored the thunk it made when it hit the slack. It was perfect. Quentin reported the altitude. 4,100 feet. Roy Lee whistled. We picked up 1,000 feet. We'll be at a mile next time. I nodded in agreement. We will, but this is the last time we fly with rocket candy. I had already talked over what I was about to say with Quentin. We had learned about another promising combination of chemicals in one of Miss Riley's classes. Next time we fly, we'll be with a new propellant, zinc dust and sulfur. We're going for maximum altitude. Sherman frowned. What do we know about zinc dust and sulfur? Not much, but we'll learn. Odell protested. But rocket candy's doing great. I don't think we ought to change. I was adamant, acting like a tough guy. Zinc dust and sulfur, that's next. If you don't like it, quit. Who elected you king? Sherman demanded. I'm in charge, and that's the way it is. Roy Lee hung back while the other boys stalked off. For God's sake, Sonny, take it easy. Don't start with me, Roy Lee. Quentin and I are going to design a sophisticated nozzle, and we need an advanced propellant to go along with it. Okay, then why didn't you explain that to the others? Because I don't have time to explain everything I do. What's your hurry? We are going to win the county science fair next year, and to do that we're going to have to be twice as good as any of the Welch High students. There's a lot to be done and learned before then. Why do you want to win the science fair? Do I have to defend everything I do? Don't I already do everything in this club anyway? Roy Lee looked grim. No, you don't, but even if you did, I think you shouldn't talk to the boys that way. I don't give a rat's ass what you think. Roy Lee unleashed a surprise punch in my chest. I went sprawling onto the hard slack. I rubbed my chest. It hurt while he stood over me, his fists at the ready. He hissed at me. You moron, we've worked our tails off on your rockets, so you think you can just come down here and treat us like we're nothing? If that's what you think, come on, get up, I'll knock you down again. I sat up on the slack, still holding my chest. I just want to use zinc dust and sulfur. Roy Lee shook his head. Jesus, what an idiot you are. Use whatever the hell you want. He reached out his hand to help me up. I took it, and he drew me to my feet. I'm sorry I hit you. I'm not, I said, and I wasn't. One evening, as the spring of 1960 approached, Mom came into the living room and planted herself in front of Dad, who was reading his paper. Homer, we need to go to Myrtle Beach, she announced. It was a bolt from out of the blue. Dad looked up from his paper. We are going. Miner's vacation. I mean before. We can leave this Saturday, stay Sunday, and come back on Monday. The mine will get along without you for that long. Dad was mystified. Why do we need to go to Myrtle Beach now? Mom put her hands on her hips. I'm going to buy a house down there. It was one of the few times I had ever seen Dad flustered, his paper deflated into his lap. Whoa, why do we need a house in Myrtle Beach? It's not for us. It's for me. I just need for you to come and sign the papers. They won't sell it to me without your signature. Elsie, we couldn't possibly afford to buy a house in Myrtle Beach or anywhere else. Mom pulled a small black book out of her apron pocket and tossed it in his lap. That's my savings account over at Welch. For the last 20 years, you've given me your paycheck every month and depended on me to pay all the bills. Well, I've done that, but I've also invested what I could in the stock market. I could buy 2 houses if I wanted to. Dad opened the book and looked it over with his good eye. He turned the pages until he got to the last one that had writing in it. My God, Elsie, where did you get all this money? I told you, the stock market. Stock market? Like in New York? Mom nodded. My broker's in Bluefield. He's been calling me all these years while you're at work. Dad struggled to make sense of the news. What stocks did you buy? Coal and steel? Mom laughed heartily. Homer, please, give me some credit. No, I paid attention to what worked with the boys, like Band-Aids. I bought a ton of stock from the company that made the best ones. Mom had passed Dad's grasp of reality. Well, I always figured after retirement. I can't wait until then, Homer. Anyway, you'll work here until you drop. Not me. I'll be at Myrtle Beach. Dad was shocked. You're leaving me? Let's say I'm setting up our retirement house in advance. I'll come back here for holidays, or when you really need me. But what about the boys? Jim's gone. I've got plenty of money to pay Sonny's way to college, if that's what he wants. I'll stay until the day he leaves. Dad still couldn't make any sense of it. But what will the people in Colwood say? My mother's answer startled us both. In a sweet voice, she said, Homer, I don't give a shit what they say. At our BCMA meeting the next morning, Billy broke some more incredible news. Did you hear Miss Ryla's sick? Some kind of cancer. My mouth fell open. I felt like I'd been turned inside out. What are you talking about? Mrs. Turner told Emily Sue. Emily Sue told me. Everything suddenly fell into place. Since Christmas vacation, Miss Riley had stopped standing during class, teaching instead from her chair behind her desk, and asking one of us boys to come up and perform her experiments. Once in February, when snow covered the ground, she'd left class and hadn't returned. Mr. Turner came to the classroom to tell us to finish reading the chapter we were on and to be quiet. He gave no explanation for Miss Riley's absence. He looked pale, as if he'd seen something that frightened him, and none of us could imagine anything that could scare Mr. Turner. In physics class that day, I tried not to stare at Miss Riley, but I couldn't help it, and she caught me at it more than once. She looked wan, and her eyes were puffy. After class, she made me stay behind to talk to her. It seemed like you were a million miles away today, Sonny. I resisted asking her about her cancer. It had been ingrained in me by my mother to never poke my nose into anybody's business. If Miss Riley wanted me to know, she would tell me. I was thinking about the science fair. That was at least partly true. It had crossed my mind. I still didn't know exactly what I was going to display or how I was going to display it. She nodded. I've been meaning to talk to you about the fair. You know, only one name can go on an entry. You put all the boys in your club down on the form. I changed it. You're the one. I protested. But all of us work on our rockets. Miss Riley held firm. You'll represent us at the fair because you're the one who knows the most. Quentin could do it. He knows as much as I do. She smiled. Maybe, but you know Quentin. He'd try too hard, probably lose the judges with his vocabulary. When I just stood there, dumbly watching her, she lost her smile and said, I presume you've heard I'm sick. She had dropped it on me like 10 tons of coal. I blurted, Yes, what's wrong? She began to teach me. What I have is called Hodgkin's disease. It's a form of cancer that attacks the lymph nodes. Here. She took my hand and placed it on her neck. This is where I first noticed that I had swelling. Feel that lump? That's one of the places where it is. I've been tired the whole school year, so I knew something was wrong. The doctors ran many tests until they were certain what I had. I drew my hand away, frightened at touching such an awful thing inside her. I didn't know anything about cancer except it killed you, but then I remembered Dad had survived his colon cancer. Maybe Miss Riley could survive this Hodgkin's thing, too. Are you going to be all right? She put an elbow on her desk and cradled her head in her palm. She raised an eyebrow and looked into my eyes. I don't know. Hodgkin's disease can go into remission. That means I'll still have it, but I won't be sick. The doctor said to just stay as healthy as I can, get plenty of sleep, eat whatever I want, that kind of thing. The worst thing is, I won't be much help to you on the science fair. After a day of teaching, I just can't keep my eyes open. You're going to have to prepare for it by yourself. Can you do that? I didn't know if I could, but I said, yes, ma'am, anyway. The bell sounded for the next class, and she waved me away. In the spring, on a Thursday afternoon, Mom drove me over the mountain to the McDowell County Science Fair in Welch. The Buick was loaded down with the panels, posters, and rocket hardware of my fair exhibit. I had decided to title my entry, A Study of Amateur Rocketry Techniques. The other boys followed in Roy Lee's car and helped me carry my hardware up to the Welch High School gymnasium, which sat high on the side of a steep hill. Mr. Turner had given us the afternoon off from school. Except for Mom, we were on our own. Miss Riley was out sick. Nervously, we set up the display, which consisted of three hinged fiber boards on which I had taped a number of posters showing nozzle calculations, the parabolic trajectory of our rockets, and the trigonometry we had used to calculate altitudes. I also had drawings of the nozzles and casements and how they worked. Werner von Braun's autographed photograph sat in a place of honor, and in front, lying down, was the casement for AUK 15, our most recent rocket. Our new zinc dust and sulfur propellant combination worked great. Of course, we'd managed to get into a little scrape with the town authorities because we'd bought some illegal moonshine to use as a binder, but it was worth the trouble. Zinco-shine, as we called it, had propelled our rockets as high as 10,000 feet. Beside the casement was one of the nozzles that Mr. Caton had built in the machine shop. It was a beautiful construction, the intricate curves glowing silvery in the light. We made a quick audit of our competition. A Welch High School display of plant fossils found in coal mines seemed our stiffest competition. Odell brushed it off. Just a bunch of old rocks, nothing to worry about. I wasn't so certain. Each fossilized plant was identified, and there was also a chart showing the evolution of plants from the dinosaurs to the present day. I thought it was a good job, and I suspected the judges would think so too. The Pocahontas Industrial Council for Education was the sponsoring organization, a committee created by the businesses in Welch and some of the larger coal mines. Odell said the judges were Welch courthouse politicians, whatever that meant. There were six of them, and they came and stood in a little semicircle around me when it was my turn. They each carried a clipboard.
What high school are you from, son?
Big Creek, sir. Miss Riley's physics class. One of them squinted at a casement.
You ever blow anything up?
I thought about Mom's rose garden fence and mentally crossed my fingers. We tend to be careful, sir.
Didn't you set that forest fire over at Davy?
No, sir. That was an airplane flare. Another judge pointed at the nozzle.
What's that?
I expounded on what it was for, how its dimensions were calculated, and what it did. A judge pointed at the casement.
How high will it fly?
I think around 3 miles. I explained how I made that judgment and how we'd measure it when the time came. The six men rocked on their heels and looked at one another and all mmmed at the same time.
Looks like to me this could be really dangerous, said the one who had asked about the forest fire.
He frowned, wrote something down, and then they went off to look at the other displays. Odell and Quentin came out from behind our display.
Those morons won't let you win, not after you said you were from Big Creek.
Quentin muttered.
Looks like to me this could be really dangerous, like what isn't in the pursuit of science.
At that point, I was just happy to have it over with. I had done the best I could. Mom took us all to lunch at the Flatiron Drugstore. When we returned, The judges were waiting for me in front of my display. The lead judge shook my hand and handed me a blue ribbon.
"Congratulations, Mr. Hickam. Looks like you're going to Bluefield for the area finals."
Odell jumped into the air.
"I knew we'd win!"
He took the ribbon out of my hand and, to the amusement of the judges, did a little jig. Mom stood to one side, a pleased, proud smile on her face. She hugged Quentin when he came over to her. I was still trying to accept what had happened. I couldn't entirely believe it. We'd won. I couldn't wait to tell Miss Riley. And Dad. Dad was up at the mine all that evening, inside working with his foreman doing safety inspections. Mom said she'd tell him the first thing the next morning. As soon as I got off the school bus, I headed for Miss Riley's classroom. She was at her desk. When I told her we'd won, she gave me a big, happy grin and sent a runner to tell Mr. Turner. The principal tracked me down in history class and ordered me out into the hall. He almost grinned.
"I just made $5 off the county superintendent. When's the next contest?"
I told him the area finals in Bluefield were to take place in 2 weeks.
"Got to get my bet in," he said, and went at a near trot back toward his office.
Mom and Dad left for Myrtle Beach the following Friday, and I had the house to myself. It was also the weekend of the junior-senior prom. With the Buick gone, Uncle Clarence agreed to let me use his car. I had asked Melba June, a sophomore that I had danced with at the Christmas formal, to be my date, and she had jumped into my arms right there in the auditorium. I saw Dorothy sitting alone watching us. She looked away quickly. Dorothy had a new boyfriend, Roy Lee said, another college guy, but he also said things weren't working out. I made it a special point not to care. An orchid corsage in hand, I picked up Melba June, and together we strolled into the Big Creek High School gymnasium, a proud couple. We danced nearly every dance. To my disappointment, Dorothy didn't show. When I took Melba home, we fogged up the windows good in the Mercury before she gave me a final adoring kiss and skipped up to her porch where her parents patiently and secretly waited for her to finish smooching the great rocket scientist and science fair winner. They opened the front door the moment her dainty little foot touched the first step. Mom and Dad got back late on Monday after I'd gone to bed. When I came in from school on Tuesday, I found Mom humming around with a contented little smile on her face and Dad in the basement poking into the dark corners of the junk down there whistling. I had never heard him whistle before, didn't even know that he knew how. I asked Mom about his behavior. She smiled at me. "Your dad's quitting. He's going into real estate at Myrtle Beach. We're moving as soon as you go to college this fall. We're figuring out what we'll take and what we'll leave behind." Dad came bounding up the stairs two at a time, as excited as any time I had ever seen him, with the possible exception of when the West Virginia coaches came to see Jim.
"I don't think we need a thing down there. We can even leave the washer. Sonny's almost worn out the top of it anyway. We'll buy everything new at the beach."
To my astonishment, he hugged her. I got through my classes during the next week in a haze. Roy Lee drove us to Bluefield for the fair, and together we set up the panels and the displays. Once more I submitted myself to the judges while the other boys hovered nearby. I gave a little speech, and then my answers to their questions. We returned after lunch for the presentations. The third prize, and then the second prize, was announced. I felt my stomach twinge. "Oh, God, please, no," I thought. We weren't going to win anything. What an embarrassment to go back to Big Creek with nothing. As soon as we'd gotten outside our little county, we'd been a complete and utter failure. The head judge stood up and leaned on the podium.
"First prize goes to, and this is a first for this high school, ladies and gentlemen, Big Creek High School, represented by Homer Hadley Hickam, Jr., for A Study of Amateur Rocketry Techniques."
Quentin couldn't contain himself. He jumped up and yelled, "Whoo, whoo," before subsiding in embarrassment. Odell danced around with both hands in the air like a victorious boxer. Roy Lee cackled and then slugged me hard on my arm. Sherman laughed and clapped his hands. Billy sat back in his chair, wiping his forehead in relief. The auditorium burst into applause. I just sat there with a big, silly grin on my face. I couldn't believe it.
We'd won.
We were going to the National Science Fair. When things settled down, we got yet another award. An Air Force major stood and announced that we had earned a first prize certificate for being outstanding in the field of propulsion. He talked about our exhibit, saying it contained the most sophisticated rockets he'd seen this side of Cape Canaveral. After the presentations were over, the major came by to shake my hand. He said he hoped I'd consider the Air Force as a career. I had the other boys come over, and when I introduced them, he beamed and said, "The United States Air Force would love to have each and every one of you." He had apparently not noticed Sherman's shriveled leg or Quentin's doubtful slouch. The month until the science fair in Bluefield seemed to flash by. There was so much to do to get ready. Happily, Miss Riley seemed to blossom with the spring. The color returned to her cheeks, and her eyes became bright once more. Every day after classes were done, she worked with me on my presentation skills. She also called teachers in other high schools who had sent students to the Nationals, just to get some tips on how to prepare and present. Every day I honed my spiel a little more so that I could quickly deliver a learned presentation on the mathematics of the design of de Laval nozzles, the calculations of specific impulse and mass ratios, and the trigonometry of altitudes needed for an amateur rocketry test range. Quentin came to my house on weekends and helped me prepare charts and diagrams of the nozzle functions, rocket trajectories, and fin designs. Odell found a piece of black velvet somewhere in which to lay out our rocket hardware. He also built some wooden boxes to hold it all, cushioned with newspaper for protection. Sherman and Billy took photographs of Cape Colwood and put them in a photo album. Roy Lee made 3x5 cards for each nozzle, nose cone, and casement, with a description of its dimensions and function. While the boys and I kept our eye on the National Science Fair, the Colwood mine was idled by a strike. Some miners, desperate to make some money, tried to enter to work on the Hoot Owl shift, but were chased away by union picketers. The company store gave credit until it couldn't anymore. Neither the company or the union seemed to be in any mood to settle. Mr. Caton had gone begging to Mr. Dubonnet, and the union chief had unbent just enough to let him build me the nozzles, casement, fins, and nose cones I needed for my display. One set of nozzles showed evolutionary BCMA's designs, from the simple countersink version to our latest beauty with an ablative coating. They were all jewels. Mr. Caton had done himself especially proud on one of them, cutting all the waste metal off it until the converging, diverging angles could be seen from the outside. I was certain it looked as good as any nozzle on any rocket taking off from Cape Canaveral. At home, Dad still went to work every day, joining his foreman for safety inspections and even rock dusting when necessary. He passed by all our display preparations in the basement going and coming from the mine, but said nothing to me about them. He was gone by the time I got up in the morning, and I was either in my room studying or in my bed by the time he got home. He had kept his promise to help me when I asked for it, but seemed to take very little interest in my upcoming trip to Indianapolis. I didn't expect anything else. On the weekend, Mom pestered him now and again about when he was leaving Colwood and moving to Myrtle Beach, but he always had an excuse. The big Trailways bus at the Welch station accepted my panels and boxes of hardware in its yawning luggage bays. The boys, Mom and Dad, Mr. Caton, Mr. Farrow, Mr. Dubonnet, Melba June, and Mr. Turner were all there to see me off. Melba June gave me a big kiss right on my mouth in front of my mother, making me turn nearly purple with embarrassment. Just before I climbed aboard the bus, I was happy to see Jake roll in his Corvette. I was even happier to see Miss Riley in the passenger seat. I went over to Miss Riley. She opened the door, and I knelt beside her when she didn't make any move to get out. I wondered if she was feeling tired again. She held her hand out to me. "Show them what West Virginians can do, Sonny." "Yes, ma'am." We looked at each other, and she pulled me in, gave me a big hug. Mom patted me on my arm at the door of the bus. Dad shook my hand without comment, scowling because he had just caught sight of Mr. Dubonnet. The two were taking turns giving each other dirty looks as my bus pulled out. We arrived in Indianapolis around noon, and I unloaded my displays at the cavernous Indiana Exposition Hall. I was directed to an area on the outer edge of the displays with other exhibitors of propulsion projects. I made a quick inspection of their displays and was relieved to find that none of them approached the sophistication of the BCMA's designs. A lantern-jawed boy from Lubbock, Texas, sat up beside me. He was wearing a cowboy hat. He had two designs, one of them using plumbing hardware for rocket nozzles, the other a demonstration of an electromagnetic launcher with little colored lights that ran the length of a track that sent a little ball bearing flying off at a pretty good clip. We became instant friends. His name was Orville, but he asked me to call him Tex. Tex gave me some news, and it wasn't good.
"We ain't gonna win nothing up here, sonny. Look around. All the prizes go to the big expensive projects."
Feeling small and lost in the huge hall amidst all the hurrying people going to and fro, I walked with Tex through the other displays and saw what he meant. Most of them were huge, complex, and obviously very expensive. One of them even featured two monkeys in a self-contained biosphere complete with oxygen-generating plants and a food pellet delivery mechanism. I had never seen a live monkey before, and here were two, in of all things, a science fair display. "The way to Mars," it proclaimed. I was stunned. All of a sudden, my future seemed cloudy, and my shiny new nozzles crude. Tex shrugged. "Most of these monster displays are from New York or Massachusetts. Lots of money involved, and these guys are just plain smart anyway. Something else, too. The judges don't like rocket projects. They figure them to be too dangerous. I knew when I came up here I didn't have a chance to win anything."
"Then why did you come?"
"Because it's fun. You'll see." Tex was right. It was fun. He and I wowed the people who came to see our exhibits, telling them about our studies and what it was like to fire off a real rocket. I used my hands a lot and made big whooshing noises. It was like I was an actor on a stage, and I found I enjoyed the attention as long as people didn't press in too close. I had that West Virginia need for a certain amount of space between me and a stranger. The judges were to make their review on the fourth day of the fair. The night before the third day, we were all treated to a big dinner and then packed off to our hotel rooms. Tex and I had already swapped with our assigned roommates and were sharing a room. We walked the streets of Indianapolis, which seemed to me a huge metropolis with cars whizzing past and crowds on the street, friendly but too many of them for me to feel comfortable. I also felt a vague discomfort at the space around me, and then I realized I was missing the mountains. In West Virginia, they were always there, setting real physical boundaries between the towns and the people. In Indianapolis, people from anywhere could just come up and bump into you. The next morning, Tex and I got off the bus to stand in front of our displays for another day of fun. To my astonishment, I found my nozzles and casements gone. I just couldn't understand it. Nothing in my experience had prepared me for it. How could they be gone? Who could have taken them, and why? Tex came over.
"You didn't lock up your stuff?"
My voice cracked. "I didn't know I was supposed to." Tex showed me the wooden case he'd brought with him and the lock on it.
"This is a city. You lock up everything."
He gave me a sympathetic look.
"You need to report this to security. Come on, I'll take you."
When we finally found a guard, he heard me out and then said there'd been a bunch of kids who had come in the night before. They had probably swiped my things. I heard what he was saying, but I couldn't believe it. "But why would they do that?" The guard looked at me. "Where are you from, son?"
"West Virginia," Tex said, as if that explained everything. And I guess it did.
I went back, despairing, to my display. I still had the pictures of all the rocket boys, Miss Riley in the physics class, the machine shop, Mr. Bykovsky, Mr. Farrow, Mr. Caton, and all the machinists, the mine tipple, my house, the basement lab with my cat perched on the dryer, all there along with my pages of nozzle calculations and my autographed photo of Von Braun. I still had Odell's piece of black velvet and Roy Lee's 3x5 cards. But without the nozzles and casements and nose cones, my display made no sense. When the judges came tomorrow, I would have nothing to show them. Tex was busy setting up his display. People were starting to come in. I felt paralyzed. Everything that had happened, our rockets, Mr. Bykovsky, Cape Colwood, calculus, had all been leading up to this judgment, and now, even though I already knew I wasn't going to win, I had this terrible sense of a chain of inevitable events leading toward some conclusion being broken. I looked at Tex. Tex, what am I going to do? Tex stopped working on his display and came over. He took off his cowboy hat and scratched his head. Reckon that little town of yours has a telephone? I had never made a long-distance call in my life. Tex took me to a phone booth, and I dialed zero and told the operator the number, and yes, this was a collect call. Mom answered, and I told her what had happened. She was speechless. Mom, I've got to get more rocket stuff somehow. Could you talk to Dad or somebody? There was a long pause at the other end. Sonny, the strike's gotten even uglier this week. Some union men chased a foreman off mine property yesterday. Your dad's threatening to go punch John Dubinet in the nose. I heard him tell Clyde the company might call in the state police. She sighed. I'll do what I can. I felt suddenly foolish and selfish. Here she was telling me the whole town was falling apart, that my dad and Mr. Dubinet were about to get in a fistfight, and that maybe the state police were going to come in, and I was whining that I wanted my rocket stuff. Mom, I was struggling against the part of me that wanted to scream, cry, and beg. Mom, it's okay. Honest, I'm sorry I called. No, no, Sonny, you're right to call. I'll see what I can do, but I'm not promising anything. You understand? I hung up and went back to my display. People glanced my way and kept going to the other contestants. I found a box and sat down on it. Anyway, I thought Tex was right. Nobody in the propulsion area was going to win anything. I would just have to go home and accept the fence line gossip that I'd been too big for my britches and got what had been coming to me, sort of like my dad all these years. That night, Tex answered the hotel phone and called me. It was Mom. Can you get to the Trailways bus station in Indianapolis by 8 o'clock in the morning? My heart skipped a beat. I think so. There will be a box aboard it for you. The next morning, I had my first taxi ride. After I picked up the wooden crate addressed to me at the bus station, I told the driver I was in a hurry, and we went careening through the streets like we were in the Indianapolis 500. We skidded to a halt in front of the exhibition center, and the driver helped me with the box, and we went running to my display area. Tex came over and helped me set up, and I reached in my pocket to pay the driver. He had been looking at my photos and shook his head. I'm from West Virginia. You don't owe me a thing except to do good. Less than an hour later, a dozen adults marched into our area. They were the judges. One of them was a young man who spoke in a Germanic accent. I was flabbergasted when he said he was on Von Braun's team. It was like being interviewed by St. Paul or somebody out of the Bible. Then he started asking me hard questions. I was ready, my pitch rolling off my tongue. My interpretation of the definitions of specific impulse and mass ratio especially seemed to impress him. When the other judges were finished with me, the young man turned and said, "You know Dr. Von Braun's here today, don't you?" My mouth dropped open. "No, sir, where?" He waved vaguely toward the center of the auditorium. "Tex, will you watch my stuff?" Tex laughed. "Sure, get an autograph for me." I took off in search of the great man himself. I wandered the aisles, getting myself lost, asking people if Dr. Von Braun was nearby. Always it seemed I just missed him. An hour later, defeated, I returned to my display. Tex regarded me sadly.
"Man, I hate to tell you, but he was just here. He picked up that nozzle, sonny."
Tex pointed at the special contoured one Mr. Caton had reproduced.
"He said it was a marvelous design and wished he could meet the boy who built it."
I ran in the direction that Tex pointed, but it soon became apparent that Dr. Von Braun was gone. Disappointed, I returned to find that I had missed another visit, this one from the judges, to leave a certificate of my prize and a beautiful gold and silver medal. I went to make my second long-distance call ever. I stepped off the bus in Bluefield to a sea of familiar faces, accompanied by applause and cheers, brandishing the surprise medal I had garnered. The first voice I heard was Mr. Caton's. "The strike's settled." Before I